nanohub.org.
Online simulation and more for nanotechnology.
Professor Shubin is the Chancellor Professor of Industrial Engineering and Operations Research at the University of California, Berkeley. He joined IE faculty at UC Berkeley in 1999, where he served as the department chair from 2001 to 2005. We just talked about how bad it is to be a department chair.
I'm a survivor. I mean, you can do it.
Prior to joining UC Berkeley, Lee was the Andrew S. Schulz Jr. Professor of Industrial Engineering at Cornell University, which is also his alma mater. Professor Shubin is a world-renowned scholar in simulation and system modeling. He has made seminal contributions to statistical methods for simulation output analysis. The diversity of application domains that he has worked on is truly stunning. He has worked on semiconductor fabs to pharmaceutical production and bioreactors. Lee's list of awards and accolades is longer than many people's complete resumes, so I'm not going to list all of them. But just to name a few, he's a fellow of InFOS, he's a fellow of World Innovation Foundation, and a winner of several outstanding teaching and publication awards. But perhaps the most distinguished accolade for any academic, he has produced several extremely successful students who have gone on to become leaders of the profession themselves. What makes today's Pritzker Distinguished Lecture so special is Lee and Alan were close collaborators for a number of years. Lee was also a close collaborator of several faculty in the School of Industrial Engineering. His lecture today, is titled, Don't Try This in the Real World. And really an intriguing topic, focusing on the origins of simulation, especially at Purdue, and what is needed or what we need to be aware of with power of simulation. So please join me in welcoming Professor Lee Shubin.
Thank you. Thanks. Okay. So don't try this in the real world. I'm referring to this talk I'm about to give. You're not supposed to do something like this in the real world, but I'm going to try it anyway. The subtitle is, Do Try Them in the Simulated World. And so I'm going to talk about some things. Our basic agenda is things we can do in the simulation world, why we should do them, and why we don't. But before I go into it, I want to say at least a quote from Alan that was important to me. I was here my first sabbatical from Cornell. I had a choices of Austria or California or West Lafayette. There was no choice. You come here because that's where Alan was. And I played squash with Alan regularly during the years. And that was the time that he was making the decision to go full-time with Pritzker Associates and leave academia. Being the star of academia. And it was an agonizing decision. We talked about it quite a bit. I learned a lot from him. His main concern was he had many people whose mortgages depended on him. He was serious about the people. And he also taught me why it's called squash. He was a little aggressive on the court. but this quote, I edited it. I hope the author forgives me. It was me. It was just way too long, as you'll recognize as this speech goes on. Most everything I do is going to be too long, but I'll try to keep fast. He's a first-rate practicing engineer, and everybody knows that he's created things. He started out by producing some code with Philip Kibiot and GASP and QGIRT, which was source code that anybody could use, and he didn't have to redo everything from scratch. It's hard to make money when you're publishing the source code, but he did. Then he had the idea we could put these two together and form SLAM and have it integrated. And still, when I did a consulting job, I always like to have the source code. You'll see why in a second, because I won't use something unless I can see what's inside the box, unless I can mess with it. And he would send me source code to SLAM PL1 and just sign an NDA, go with it. Very trusting and nurturing kind of fellow. And so as an engineer, he won the Gilbert Award, he's scholarly researcher, National Academy of Engineering, one of the first industrial engineers to be in there. He was the first winner of the Lifetime Achievement Award, which is the Nobel Prize of Simulation. One of the winners was knighted by the Queen of Netherlands for winning this award. So if we had a queen, Alan would be Sir Alan. And successful entrepreneur, he was Venture Magazine's Entrepreneur of the Year. Entrepreneur of the Year. I can't say capitalist because I'm from California. So many people model their careers after Alan. I'm one of them. Everybody has tried. No one's done all these four very well. One of the things Alan did, major accomplishment, was he attracted Bruce Schmeiser here from SMU. And that was an important contribution to me. It got me here, but also, yeah, well, ask me later about that. And we'll just talk about what I was going to talk about. Yeah. At the end of the talk.
And Bruce influenced.
At the end of the talk, maybe. I'd like to talk about me first. You know.
Okay. I mean.
So, my favorite topic. Okay, so we're talking about models. This is what the world we could do stuff in. There's nouns, model, people, what is it? It's one system used to study another. It could be a mathematical system of equations used to study something real. It could be a system of belief used to think about something else. So it's very general. But you don't have study the same system. And a model is also a verb. It's a transitive verb. It's just using one system to study another. It's a form of communication. And it's also a form about how we think about the world. And if you have one modeling discipline and one thing you think about, you're never going to learn anything. Because you need to have another way to think about something to learn. And once you know two things about two things, then you're in trouble. Because if you only know about two things, you can only see differences. And you need to know three things to see similarities. And so you got to keep learning different techniques. And I think one of the problems people make early in their career is they say, I'm going to do integer programming, particular kind. And then you need to do this. It's a transitive verb, needs an object to be active. I just got my new PowerPoint, so I have this display thing. And some of the things that are different about model, I'll just show you, just to get an idea. Real world, multiple objective, different people want different things, single objective, qualitative. A lot of things in the real world you can't quantify. Our model, we try to quantify. Dynamic rules, we're programming static rules. Real world's on the real thing. We're on the discrete. Open and closed on our environment. Adaptive, non-adaptive, flexible, rigid. Transient, resonant, that's kind of an important concept that everything in our model is some memory we've allocated, maybe dynamically. But we've modeled things that come and go through there. Customers going through a grocery store or patients going through a hospital, they're transient. People, academics, retiring, that's a transient. We're all kind of in the real world, there's transients and then we have these residencies. Nasty thing for people in my field is the real world is dependent, non-stationary, and unstable. People tend to like to join shorter lines, so it's state dependent. Fridays don't look like Tuesday mornings in an emergency room, so it's not stationary. There's time changes, and it's unstable. They're rush hours. Whereas we kind of model things as independent, identically distributed, which is none of the above, nothing real. And then if you hear someone say ID exponential, you probably should try to walk away slowly. If you see them exponential with a mean less than one, you can run away because nobody cares about stable queues. They care about rush hours and things like this. And so you do have to realize that the world that we're modeling, a lot of us, is quite a bit different. There's good news. In the simulation world, we can assume, since our data is marginally cheap, it's hard to get that first data point because you got to build a model, but afterwards each data point's really cheap. So you get huge samples, and you better because your asymptotic's going to work. You can assume things are ID normal in the output if you play your game right. Real world's uncontrollable. It's unobservable. Model world, we can control things. We can watch them. We don't have to wait till next year to see how fat the pig is. We can watch it grow. Stuff happens in the real world. Totally causality in our model. It's not in there if we didn't put it there. So these are things we can exploit, things we can do that we can't do in the real world. And George Box, you know, all models are wrong, some models are useful. And if you look at model as a verb, they're useful because they're wrong, because you learn something there. So I think that's one of our major quotes. Things we can do. Control and observe the input. And some of these things I'm going to run through pretty quick. I'm not expecting you, how to say this, to really understand this talk particularly, or I hope you're interested. But my stories and my presentations are either short, accurate, or interesting, and I usually can do one of those, maybe two. And so we'll try to keep it moving. This is a simulation. I'm going to contrast this with a real-world experiment. I've got some sort of output Y, and I've got two inputs, X, and I can set it minus one, plus one, and I can run a simulation or a model and get that value plus one and run it again, get it minus one. I can analyze it and draw a straight line there and have a model there that Y is some intercept, theta zero, and some slope, theta one. And I'm happy with that. Unless I do it again. If I do it again, I might get different answers. So I've got a little bit of a problem, but I'll go ahead and analyze that. And I've got a different model. If I run a bunch of these and analyze it, then I've got a problem that I'm not seeing any kind of consistency, perhaps. And so what statisticians do is they add this little term up here, this error term. I've got another parameter. I don't know the variance of that error. I don't know its mean either. But I'm going to take all the sins I've committed there and throw them in that epsilon of sigma, which means the model isn't really a straight line. I don't really have controllable input X. If I set the temperature for a bioreactor at this temperature, it's not going to really be that temperature. It's going to be a little different. So I don't really set that. Don't have the right model, and I don't observe the same thing because there is some inherent things missing. All the missing stuff, we call that epsilon. So there's a lot of sins in there that we're dealing with in our model. And so an example of a real-world experiment that was given to me by an aircraft company, they wanted to had a simulation of aircraft flight, and they had this dipole in place thing. It's a dip switch. Had 32 settings. It took 20 minutes to evaluate each one of those settings, combinations of settings. So that's a 2 to the 32 factorial design they wanted to run. I said, well, that'd be great that you've got 160,000 years. We could find out which setting to make is optimal for that. So they have to do something different in your simulation. So one of the things everybody knows about simulations that's messed with it a little bit is you control the uncertainty. You have something, a random number seed. That's random number. It's generated by a computer. That's not possible, but we're going to do it anyway. And we're going to control that, control uncertainty. That's an oxymoron of high class, you know, but that's what we can do. Got this black box. And we're going to put our X's in there. Those are input factors. And we're going to have a bunch of random number streams that we generate by a computer. Forgive us. Goes into simulation model. And out comes a bunch of outputs. We replicated our time to get a bunch of other outputs. And then if I assume some things about the behavior of these outputs, like they're random variables, that only, I don't get the same number every time I do this. If they're a random variable, I'll just say it has a variance, and they're not uncorrelated. So this is correlation that is of magnitude rho. This was my PhD thesis. It was 140 pages long. My advisor said, how come you have all the filler in it? Because, you know, there's about 20 pages that were interesting literature review. And then there was a theorem, which you'll see. Theorem zero, my one and only. We run independent streams. We get stuff like this. And the variance of our intercept, we're interested in this little theta zero, and we're interested in how steep it is. We're not, you know, worried too much about a lack of fit at this point. That epsilon is going to take care of everything. If we run it with common streams, we get things that are, so we get something low down here, then we'll get something low down here, something high up here, we'll get something high over there. They tend to be in parallel. So we get a really good estimate of the slope. The variability of those three lines are not too much, but we get a nasty estimate of the intercept. So our variance of our intercept is we've added that variance, that correlation to the variance of the intercept, but we've subtracted it from the slope. So we've got a really good slope, pretty lousy intercept. And if we did antithetic streams, that means if you happen to get a high value in one, you're going to manipulate your uncertainty enough to get a low value in the other one, and they tend to be high with low. And you get a nice cross. These guys, these three runs, give you about the same value of the intercept, but nasty slopes. And you can see that down here with my simple little model of epsilon, that I've taken this variance of the intercept and right here, and I've reduced it for the intercept, moved it from the slope to the intercept, that variance there, that rho. And if rho is 1, you can see you've taken all the variance away. You've just moved it to what you wanted to do. But if you can get a fairly high rho. So let's go to two input variables. I've got x1 and x2. These are two things I can control. I get outputs, and if I use common streams, that is, I want these green lines to be in the same tails of the distribution and the reds in the same tails, but the green and reds in different tails of the distribution. If I do that, then things, wonderful thing happens, I guess, is that in this model, my intercept, that variance is reduced by rho. Imagine rho pretty close to 1, so that's getting pretty small. If it were, this intercept in that direction, it's lower. Intercept in that direction, it's lower. Win-win. Everything's great. And then you look at a different model and say, well, I'm going to take some of that epsilon and say, well, what if there's this interaction, this slope tilts a little bit? And I look at that, and I'm wondering about this tilt. I'm going to estimate that from my runs. And those three little rows that I subtracted off my variance, they all just showed up down there. You can't win it. That's where they are. They're all down there. And so I have theorem zero. I gave up doing theorems after that. But in my thesis, I had to have it. And theorem zero was you want to maximize the variance of the smallest parameter. And I thought I was real proud of that, except to ask, how do you know which is the smallest parameter? Because you're going to run your experiment to find that out, right? And I had a famous statistician on my committee. It wasn't Sir R.A. Fisher. He would be the Lifetime Achievement Award winner in England, like Pritzker would be here. He was knighted. There is something good about having a monarch. I mean, I am from Berkeley. So the best way to plan an experiment, best time to plan an experiment, is after you've done it. So here we are, experimental design, planning our experiments and stuff, and we need to do it after we've done it. So what can we do? Well, we can do a little more. We can control the states. The input values, the x's, we set those things. There's a lot of things we can do by observing and controlling the states. By observing it, we don't need to estimate this variance here by replicating. We can do batching, and there's this brilliant thing called overlapping batching from Bruce Schmeiser and Mark Mackinton and others. Standardized time series, regenerative methods, lots of different methods, you name it. There's tons of ways of dealing with the fact that we can observe this run. We can watch it change as it's going. We don't just run it. A year later, we weigh the pig and see how fat it is. We can watch it grow in detail. And the data is cheap, so our asymptotic models, they work. All those things that you're wondering in stats class, so law of large numbers and central limit theorem and all that, Brownian motion, why does that matter? Well, that's a good model for your output because you've got a lot of data. Let's see a little more about controlling our input. One of the tricks you can do there is these input factors, you don't have to leave them constant during a run. You can change them while it's running. Typically, you set these, you run the simulation, and you see what you got. But you can change them during the run. In particular, one of the things you can do if you're an engineer and you have a different brand of engineering training than I had, you tend to like to oscillate things, Fourier basis, etc. So I had a little sinusoid. So rather than X being fixed during the run, I'm going to wiggle it during the run. And X can be a lot of things. But if I were to wiggle X during a run, this is X wiggling, the output is amplified by the slope I'm looking for. And if I run it and I have the wrong model, it's one of these quadratics, I'm wiggling this thing down here and the frequency's doubled. And so I can run it once, I'll run it twice, I want to see what the noise is. So you get a signal-to-noise ratio, in two runs I can see what my model's pretty good or not. The example of this was done by a PhD student myself using a model from Tom Schreiber. I have really profited by having SCH as the beginning letters of my name. Tom Schreiber. Many people have assumed that I'm Tom Schreiber. Many people have assumed I'm Bruce Schmeiser. It's worked great. You probably are thinking that already, but I put on weight, okay? So you've got these different things you can oscillate. For instance, this time between storms. That's a continuous number. That's not so exciting. How about the distribution shape? You can oscillate that while during the run. Or some things that are discrete, like the number of tugboats in this little harbor model. 1 or 3 are the two runs I would make, but I'll oscillate between 1 and 3. just oscillate a probability and flip a coin with that percentage. Works, those are the spikes. That's the same factor you would get from these two runs that you would have gotten running the bunts. I've used this, I love this slide because I always say this wrong in deference to Indiana's late senator and our vice president, Dan Quayle. Used to call this a nuclear waste, and he got the next word wrong. It's not a suppository, it's a repository. And this is where they're going to put the stuff. And they did a study of the stuff, and they did a bunch of huge model. Anything they could think of was in there. One of the factors they looked at is, well, where would we put it if there were a thermonuclear exchange? That's a nuclear war. Well, people, you know, it would turn out that factor didn't matter too much. Once the war was happening, so they could eliminate that. You oscillate that, and now you got nothing. But they did have those factors in. There's a lot of money being spent to where to do this. So to control that, we can also control time. To do that, I'm going to have to dig a little bit deeper under the hood. And to do that, I'm going to turn that black box into a white box. And we're going to change these things while it's running. Just the input factors. We're going to change a lot of stuff while it's running. So this is my example. I'm going to start off with one of these process flow models. This happened to be GPSS. If you know it, they have little shapes like this, and you have little customers coming through here, and they spend some time, and they're served. And so this is a model you may see a little bit later, but that's the system. We've got a bunch of jobs that got to be processed. We've got three red parallel servers that process them. They get in line. Our data is how many servers we got, the time between arrivals, service time. Our state is going to be the number of customers in the system, and here it's 8. Okay? You need to kind of understand this part to believe the next part. But you probably won't believe the next part if you do understand this. So let's go with it. There's a couple of states that are interesting. I only need to know whether I've got an idle server or not. One of these guys is not busy. When a new job arrives, is one of these idle or not? I can determine that by knowing whether the number in the system is less than the number of people serving it. And I also need, when a job finishes working, I need to know whether there's more work for that job. Can it take a break, or does it have to work more? And I can tell that by this Q greater than R. So those two conditions tell me the state of the service. And so we can look at the relationship between events. And this is if you know me, you know this is how I'm going to bring you in, and there's a bet going on, and I know it, and I'm in the pool anonymously. How long will it take him to mention event graphs? Which slide will it be? Well, let's see. The winner is, okay, well, this is what we have in a discrete event simulation. They're all this way. And it's Turing complete, so you can model into your languages there. You got events that schedule other events, cause other things to happen. And so we have this event A, and that could be anything happening you can think of. It'll change the state, and then you do this little condition I and see if that's true or not. If it is, then you're going to schedule B to happen sometime later. T is the time later. It's probably a random variable. So let's take our little queue. The events we care about in our queue is when a customer shows up and when they finish. Our state changes are pretty simple. When they show up, Q plus 1, that's the entire code for that process, that function. Q minus 1, that's the entire code for that function. So it just changes the Q by 1, up or down. The relationship is, somebody shows up, an idle server, they get served. How long does it take to serve them? Service time. So if that's true, we're going to schedule that finish event after the service time. When somebody finishes, is there more work? If there is, we're going to have them finish after their service time. And then we have customers arrive every TA time unit. So this is the entire model. The entire source code, there's nothing hidden. In fact, I even, for my students, put comments in. You got to comment your model. That's what it's happening, okay? So there's your code. It's everything except my initial state and my first event, which is I'm going to have somebody arrive to an empty queue or something like that. So this is going to be, in its own right, a kind of interesting model. It's very small. And the memory in your system, it has two integers. Only one of them is a variable, Q. So if you have 10,000 customers, 10 million customers, 10 customers, doesn't matter, it still has that integer. Its value is different. But it runs the same speed, so highly congested system, same speed, same memory footprint, doesn't care how big it is. Not getting all the information you might want, but you can do that too. So You can do that by using a priority queue, which most of the languages do this to give you some output. Everything I want to know about that rival, I'll generate it and put it in a list. And everything I want to know about this departure, I'll get it off that list and tell you, like how long they waited and things like this. So same picture though. Two little circles and three little arrows. And that models that. Process flow modeling, a lot of people are used to this kind of thing. But this is, if you want to look under the hood, there's what you see and there's under the hood for this particular model. Just so you don't think we're dealing with stuff that is trivial, this is a general network where we have any kind of jobs, any kind of servers on any kind of path. It looks pretty much the same, except we want to know when something leaves, that is a job type I leaves, it doesn't change its type, it's still type I, but what's the next place it goes? Other than that, you've got yourself a network of queues, and these have been used to model some pretty huge systems. This is a biopharmaceutical plant in Berkeley, 32 acres. This is who they are, the people. This is their annual production, right there. Okay, it's a fistful of powder. That's how much they make a year. This is a life-saving drug. If you don't get your shot, you die. And so when I saw this, I thought, okay, I'm going to get into biopharmaceuticals because if we could double the powder, then a lot more people get to live. And to do that, then that's worked out. That's worked out nicely. A couple of graduate students formed a company that has done this, and they've used essentially the model I showed you. A lot of them. I had two subscripts in that, they had 300. So it's a high-dimensional array of those little things I showed you. And it looks like this. And this is interesting, I think, because it's a simulation model where the boxes aren't connected. In the boxes, you don't have an outside modeling team drawing a network to describe the system. The system describes itself. Each element in the system describes its activities. These can be blown up into activities. If I had to do this network, what's really going on? I wouldn't be able to do it right. But that's the computer does that part. And so it's programmed by the users. That's worked out pretty well. We're using it in emergency rooms now, where we have the activities that are going on in emergency rooms at UC Davis and UC San Francisco. They're willing to wear RFID tags walking around, and that's not new. People have done that to collect data, because in the past, people have wanted to have learning statistics to learn about the stochastic part of their model, but we're using it to learn about the dynamic part of the model, the time part. And so we have the same kinds of ideas. First thing we ran into is priorities. Got this activity, and if you've got these two people who need this activity and they could do something else and they have different priorities, they might do that other activity. And so we saw some probabilities on that. Let the thing run. It's hooked into the database. They have a lot of data here. And we noticed that there is a possible pecking order emerging depending on who the two people are. And the priorities, the procedures that get done may depend on the individual. You start to say, well, these priorities are all equal. We'll just see what you do when you have your choices. And then we'll update those probabilities. And pretty soon they're going to, well, gosh, if you're working with this person, you're going to do what they want to do. And we're seeing that matter. Okay, so how does this change what we do, a conventional experiment? We do our runs we did before, fit our model, we're pretty happy. But now we'll take in our model, look inside the box, and realize that we don't have to do these runs one at a time. We can make this model right here, which is a single model, and it just kicks off the other two, and the other two just start running. So we're running them both at the same time. And running at both at the same time, we're getting the information from both at the same time, and they're running concurrently, and if we want to do something that's kind of clever, we can use the same arrivals for both because that's external. We want to make some sure that they share random variables. There's a nice paper by Schmeiser and Kachavichianakul, which I always like to work into every talk, usually in the warm-up phase, on how one can not use inversion to get high correlations. Well, here we're using exact same random variables, so I don't care how you generate it because they're going to be the same. Or we can run four experiments or four factorial design. It's one model. We run all the factor settings at the same time. So, why do we want to do this? Well, we can also control time. Some of those factor settings, we do all during the run. So some of the factor settings are going to be important and some aren't. And we'll learn that as we're watching them all coming out. And the ones that are losers, we can start to dilate them, give them long time scales. So if I have like system A and B running, and this is like real time, and I take A's time and I, well, I actually would increase B's time scale, then this is the, I have a lot of A events occurring. So A's happening pretty fast. I'm getting a lot of information about A, not much about B. Because I don't care about B. I'm going to retire it pretty soon. I'm watching it. And if I unscale it when I'm out, I get the same output. So, little test problem show how that worked. This was done ages ago against some models ages ago that had built-in optimizations against a test case I just flashed by you that doesn't matter too much, except there was explicit cost of experimenting, cost of decision involved. There's some commercial software that was done. Taking this procedure, the cost was $8,000, not $300 or a million. So it's worth thinking about doing it. So we also have known causality. This is a little bit different version of this. I'm going to put the arrivals of customers, and then I'm going to have them start as a separate event because I want to show you something that turns out this graph is a little bit important because I have these edges here that don't have any conditions, and I have these edges that don't have any times, and they don't touch each other. And if that happens, then I can do this thing. I can describe a variable, AI, as the time of this arrival event. That's how when that ith arrival occurred. And I know that the next one's going to occur after the arrival time, so I have an equation telling me those times. I also have an equation when I start the ith service. After that service time, it's going to finish. That's an equation. There's no condition there. I've got a couple conditions telling me I can't start till I arrive, and I can't finish the next guy until I start the last guy. I have a set of linear equations. What does the simulation do? It executes the events as soon as it can. So my objective function is minimize all these times subject to the constraints of my simulation. So it's a greedy algorithm that's constrained to solve that problem. So you can do your simulations in your linear program software. And it's a little embarrassing, but Cplex is faster than any simulation tool for this particular model I've shown you. Stick it in there and the preprocessor solves it. It doesn't do any pivots. It's a very sparse matrix. Just one constraint per edge. Same thing, except I can get performance measures out of it. Something for the optimization guys. Cool thing about this is linear programs have duals. So you can look at this program differently. And the way that you look at a GG1Q, you take its dual, becomes an inventory problem, very popular inventory problem. You know, in OR, popular problems have first name the, you know, we have the MM1Q, the traveling salesman problem. We have the lot sizing problem. This is a the problem, two these, and they're duals of each other. Lot sizing problem is a hard problem if I have setup cost. It's one of those ones you win a Nobel Prize if you can figure out to solve it, follow along the time. I didn't figure that out. So if I don't put in setup cost, but I allow backordering, it's the dual of this guy. So the way to solve this lot sizing problem, best algorithm I've seen out there is n log n. I can do it in order n. I run the simulation. I simulate GG1Q, and I get the same answer. So there's stuff we can do. Why should we do them? Well, that optimization problem, there's a simulation of a cluster tool. It's a robot moving semiconductor things around. And you do the linear program, you realize in the LP there's a redundant constraint. So you take that constraint out of your simulation, improve your simulation. This is scheduling the robot, but the robot is only tested, its state is only tested on that edge you just removed. So it's an unusual scheduling problem that it's scheduling a resource in which that resource does not appear. Most scheduling problems say one if available, zero not, it's not in there. The robot's being scheduled, but there's no state of the robot. It's all implied by what the rest of the system's doing. The robot does it best it can. That's its best schedule. But it's not in the model. So you build your simulation runs, and you can see the simulation's a little better. But the linear program that's used for schedule this, it dies at about 50 wafers. Whereas the linear program that you get back from writing the linear program of the schedule where I remove that edge, it dies at about 20,000 wafers. So we've got a much better scheduling problem from just looking at it two different ways. Another reason we should do stuff. Let's look at what's happening when we take our data and we use conventional statistics. We're going to get an output of observations. I call these the YIJs. And that's going to be the ith observation of run J. I get that data out. And I got those Ys. And I want to estimate these parameters, that slope and that intercept and those parameters in my model. And those are all linear combinations, weighted sums. They're all weighted sums of those averages. So I get my data, run it out, take a weighted sum of the averages, get my parameter estimates, I test the precision accuracy, do the design again, now I can repeat it over and over again. Or if I take that equation that I did and I put in Y bar, switch the order of summation, I can see that this estimate here is an average of estimates I can observe while running. I can observe the parameter while I'm running, and let's try to make that a little clearer. So I can replicate the full design and generate the model, not data to fit the model. So you generate the model, why is that useful? Let's take a little closer look at, I love this, so I'll show it a bunch of times. There's our experiments. We're doing these replicates. And let's take a little bit a look at our parameters. And the only one that's easy to see is this intercept. During this run, this would be my estimate of the intercept, if that's all I knew. And this would be my theta zero, if that's all I knew. But if I'm running all of them at the same time, like a model like this, I would see things that happen like this. I'd see that, and I'd see those. And so what do I see from my run? During my run, I see this output. And I can look at this output over time, and I'll see it look like the following. And I can see how my output would behave while it's running, the entire experiment model combo, and see how it's running, and see, and I'm pretty happy with that intercept. But I can also get the other parameters. I can get slope, I can get the variance. Maybe the variance is a little too high, I'll let the model keep running. So I don't design the run, you know, after I run it. You design it while you're running it. What's good about this? Well, let's take a little picture here where I've got my two outputs plotted in this space, and I run it, and I get this thing up here, I run it again, I get something that's ellipse, assuming it's normal and positive correlated. And I might be interested in equal variances. I might be interested in the same model, so I'll look at this data that I've got. It's just this point in two space. And my estimate, the linear combination I do to get the intercept, is I take one half the sum, that's the average, or I take one half the difference, that's the slope, and that's exactly the projection down on those two axes, that's the length of those projections. And I can look and see what the variance of those guys are. So that's what I'm interested in, is the variance of this guy, which, since I'm using common random numbers, that's going that way, is smaller, that gives me a good slope, and I got a pretty lousy intercept, that variance is bigger. But if I'm looking for a direction to search, I want to know about not the magnitude or how big that intercept, I want to know which direction it is. So the direction is I now can run this thing and look at this gradient, and as I'm running it, I can change my times, how much effort I'm spending everywhere, and rotate that. So the thing I'm interested in, which is the direction I want to step, is minimized. Different objective. And there's a great question here I hope you don't ask. But common random numbers still work. So summary, real world, let's think we're trying to find the fastest car. We got a bunch of drivers, we got a bunch of types of tires, we got fuels, we got a bunch of stuff that can change the speeds of these cars. What we do in customary, standard experiments is time trials. We get a driver, get a car, get a fuel, we run it. Time it. Get another one, run it again. See which one's doing well. Doing time trials. We could run races. Might be more efficient to run races. Or we could, in the simulated world, not the real world, clone drivers. We wish we knew about that car. It's racing. And it's a winner. We don't care about the loser so much. We're going to retire those eventually anyway. And so we'll clone the drivers and the tires and stuff like this. Retire the slower cars. We can change the time scales to where those guys are not being watched very much. And so all these things in simulations are things we can do. And we don't have to run time trials in doing that. So why we don't do it? Well, I think if you look at my model, the evolution of this has been, you've gone to, this is another name for SLAM, which is came out as Simon, and then I guess Arena, and then some other stuff come like this. These models have taken information where I had a little bit of information about what's going on and condensed it and packaged it a little bit more each time. So it's easier to use, harder to make a mistake. Easier to animate. That's hooked together. But now the box is getting blacker. And so the good and the bad there, animation analysis, they kind of go in opposite directions. And now everybody's fighting it out in the 3D animation realm. And analysis will suffer. So the two quotes that all models are wrong, some models, I like to update that to simulation. Modeling is always useful, particularly when it's wrong. When people don't agree, then we have a chance to communicate. And wrong being, I don't agree with you. Great. If you agree with me, then you've wasted this last hour. Okay. Experiment, best time to do it after. Best simulation time is while you're doing the experiment. All righty. So, are there any questions?
I asked you earlier.
Oh, yeah. Alan Pritzker, big influence on my career, but and he brought Bruce here. And just like I mentioned, Tom Schreiber, I've followed his career a lot. Bruce, I have to confess, I used to wear a beard. I grew that beard when I visited here, because people would call me Professor Schmeiser, and I kind of liked it. And I, you know, we do look alike. I mean, I've been confused by a graduate student who thought they were coming to visit Bruce and showed up at Cornell, said, here I am. You got to ask Dave Goldsman about that. But it has happened. I see skepticism. Now, this is me with a beard. You gotta see the familiar. Come on, right? It's there, right? Let's take a look at him, okay? Bruce, come on, stand up. I wanna gut check here.
Very similar.
I always like that, yeah.